What I'm going to do is a little bit different from what you've heard so far today. I'm going to offer you some remarks, obviously unillustrated, because I thought the great outdoors would be the best illustration. You might have missed it, those of you sitting in the front of the room. And also, I want to try to act in some way as a respondent to what you've heard previously, to sort of exploit the fact that I've been given this final position in the day. So what I want to talk to you about is museums as research platforms, museums as spaces for research. And in particular, given the interests of those in the room, I want to talk about the concept of object-led research, which is a very common phrase that one hears in this country. Not something we talk about, incidentally, in America very much a British conception of what the museum curator and indeed academics and artists and others involved in museums as research contexts seem to care about. So object-led research. Now, over the course of the day, one thing that you may have noticed, with one notable recent exception that Andrew just showed you, is that the object tends to be considered as a passive thing in relationship to the researcher or to the artist or indeed to the viewer. And for good reason, our normative experience in the museum is that the object is in the case, we look at it, then we move on to the next object. Julian earlier used a very interesting phrase, which was cutting to the chase, in reference to the previous installation of ceramics at the V&A, which some of you may remember, installed in 1909 and not reopened in its new guise until 2009, so a good 100-year run, that sort of endless row of serried ranks of cases, of objects. And I think Andrew's phrase, provisional clarity, is a very good description of what that experience offered to the visitor, moments of understanding intermixed with perhaps a more pervasive sense of confusion and unknowability, a kind of infinitude, a sort of museum sublime. And just to quote one other speaker from earlier in the day, Esther Leslie, who used a wonderful phrase to describe the Märzbau of Kurt Schwitters, which was a combination of hopeless disarray and meticulous accuracy. And I would suggest to you that that is exactly the sort of experience that the V&A Ceramics Gallery is used to offer to our visitors. It's quite an unexpected connection, perhaps, because we think of Schwitters and the, in fact, roughly coterminous galleries at the V&A, the materials-based, lucid, post-Enlightenment galleries at the V&A, as occupying something like antithetical positions on the aesthetic register, and yet they seem to have a lot in common. A fitful experience of contact with a specific thing, whether it's a lock of hair associated with a friend, or a particular photograph or work of art, in the case of the Märzbau, and then these great ceramic works from the past, Chinese porcelains, English Delftwares, and the like. So these moments of provisional clarity, but then the infinite regress of repetition and the profusion of experience that cannot be contained. So that is an awful lot to take on from passive objects. In other words, they can be very powerful in that passive state, simply sitting there operating on us. But it does raise the question that was, in fact, the first question that was asked this morning, which produced a moment of interesting confusion, which was posed to Christy. Is it fair to say that your objects have agency? It's a very interesting word. And we could generalize that question. Do objects in general in museums have anything we could describe as agency, or to use a word that Janice used earlier in reference to automata, very nice word, she used the word temerity in relation to these automata that look back at you, very much as Christie's objects just a few doors down in the Freud Museum look back at you with this kind of eerie calm, this sense of penetrating observation of you as you try to observe them. So these are watchful objects. And then, on the other hand, we have the idea that objects are like the manuscripts in Goethe's rooms, like patients propped up against the walls, the walking wounded, or in fact the immobilized, impartial, incomplete remnants of the past. And another phrase that we use, the idea that a museum is an asylum for objects, like a site of refuge, a place that objects might flee to. Presents us with the idea that these passive objects and the nature of the agency that we might attach to these objects is in fact very, very weak, very paltry, very fragile. And the point that I want to make and sort of build my talk to you around is this, exactly this dichotomy or disparity, or even perhaps this dialectic, between the idea that the agency of an object sitting in a museum is strong and the idea that the agency of an object sitting in a museum is weak. And an observation that I'll make to you is that a lot of our discussion around the applied arts and fine arts, for example, but also in museological circles generally, tends to either veer in the direction of thinking about the strength of the agency of the object or towards the weakness of the agency of the object. We very rarely talk about both of them at once. So let me just give you an example. We often tend to say, for example, a Barbara Hepworth is a more powerful art object, given more status, than a teapot Barbara Hepworth sculpture. And it's an issue of hierarchy, and much has been written about this in craft theory circles. Why is that? Why do we prefer the Barbara Hepworth sculpture to the teapot? Well, you could reframe the question and ask perhaps a blunter question, like the kind that Kush and Andrew posed together, which is, what happens if you drink out of an object in a museum? And it's one thing to say, well, let's do that with a tea set. What if you were to do it with a Barbara Hepworth sculpture? What if you were to drink tea out of a Barbara Hepworth sculpture? Would a curator let you do that? Might be a good question to ask your colleague, Andrew. And of course, it seems to us inherently unlikely that that would come to pass, I think, except in a highly radicalized institutional context. And one can imagine that if it were to happen, it would probably make national news, whereas you presumably made only a more local media impression with your experiment. And what does one conclude from that? Does one conclude that the Barbara Hepworth has more agency or less? Because the teapot can take it. Yes, you have a question? Indeed, it's not. Well, in fact, you don't drink out of a teapot, so you drink out of a teacup. But you could certainly drink tea out of lots of Barbara Hepworth sculptures, couldn't you? Yeah. 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 That's that you're starting to narrow the question down a little bit. I'm trying to keep it quite general. But obviously, we could talk about why these objects are considered to have the sorts of agency they do. So the non-functionality of the Barbara Hepworth relates to the functionality of the teapot in such a way as to start to reinforce hierarchy. Then you have materials of value. So you can talk about a valuable teapot versus a less valuable teapot, a more fragile teapot versus a less fragile one, et cetera, the same for teacups. But I'm trying to make a broader, more abstract point, perhaps. Which, and please do interrupt me with questions. It's very useful to do that. I'm trying to make a broader point, which is that whatever provides the strength of agency in that Barbara Hepworth sculpture also makes it fragile, also makes it seemingly vulnerable to attack. And the reason that we think it would be more difficult to get away with the idea of drinking out of the Barbara Hepworth sculpture has something to do with strength, but it also has something to do with weakness. Now, I just want to read to you a very quick quotation, which comes from an absolutely wonderful story from Virginia Woolf called Solid Objects, recently anthologized by A.S. Byatt in a book of short stories, British short stories, which is where I found it. But you can find it online, and it's only short. Good read. And it's incidentally about a man whose life is undone by his attraction to objects, which starts off when he finds a lump of green glass in the sand on a beach. And is so attracted to it that he eventually gives up his career in the hopes of finding other objects that he will respond to just as much, not special objects from any exterior position, seemingly. At any rate, she describes the impulse that leads him to pick up this hunk of glass, and she compares it to, quote, the impulse that leads a child to pick up one pebble on a path strewn with them, promising it a life of warmth and security upon the nursery mantelpiece, delighting in the sense of power and benignity which such an action confers, and believing that the heart of the stone leaps with joy when it sees itself chosen from a million like it, to enjoy the bliss of the mantelpiece instead of a life of cold and wet upon the high road. It might have so easily been any of the other stones, but it was I. Yes, Virginia Woolf. And I think what's wonderful about that is a bit fanciful, and the idea of anthropomorphizing the object is perhaps only metaphorical here. It's very compelling, I think, and very provocative to swing the lens around, and instead of asking the question, should we be drinking out of the sculpture, should we be drinking out of the teacup in the collection, to ask, what do the objects want? Do they want anything? Is that a coherent conception? Does it help in any way, or can we make anything out of the idea of ascribing agency to objects? Now, I'm just going to leave that question hanging there for a moment and mention another idea, which is the nature of, to get back to my theme of research, the nature of curatorial expertise and how one decides that a curator is the right person to be researching an object in the first place, and what object-led research actually usually consists of. And this is a big subject, but I'm just going to make one short provocative claim about it, which is that curators, generally speaking, lay claim to authority over objects by not using them in the way in which they were originally intended, especially if they're not fine art objects. In other words, it's the displacement, not only in spatial terms, from, let's say, a home into a museum, but also in behavioral terms, that makes us feel like treating an object in a certain way is research. It makes us think that drinking tea out of a teacup at home, having just bought it at the store, isn't research, but doing something to it in a museum is research. And what kinds of things do we do, curators, when we operate with objects? Well, we do some very interesting and telling things. We turn them upside down a lot. And we also write on the bottoms a lot. So we seem to place a great deal of emphasis on the unseen undersides of things. And in fact, if you know any furniture conservators or furniture specialists, you know they spend a lot of time crawling around on the floor looking underneath and flipping things over. In other words, we look at all the parts you're not meant to look at from the perspective of a standard or normative user or manufacturer. We also look at them in unnatural ways. We subject them to x-rays and ultraviolet light, which is a good way to tell if a painting has been restored. We put them under microscopes. These days we conduct high-resolution photography, digital photography, so that we can see an object this big. In other words, we look at them unnaturally. And the more unnaturally we look at them, the more we seem to feel that we know about them, which I think is very telling. Also, when we teach with them, it's fascinating that we encourage people not to use them in the way that they were originally intended, and in fact, to do anything but. So I run a lot of handling sessions at the V&A, especially with ceramics, which are fragile, of course. And it's amazing how much a student has to be told before they're allowed to pick up a teacup. And one of the most fascinating things to me, in addition to all the other things like hold it over the table, don't bring it close to another museum object because they might smash against one another, use two hands, things like that. A great one is never handle an object by its handle, because the handle is perhaps the most fragile bit of it and it could fall off. And again, I think that's very telling. It's rather like looking at the underside or inverting the normal way of looking at something or using an optical device to look at it as if normal looking were not okay. In other words, everything about museum expertise tends towards the subliminal suggestion that normal access to the object is not enough and that we have to gain some kind of hyper-perception about the object in order to be doing research. And you could compound these examples endlessly. Another great example is turning garments inside out to look at their seams, which is something fashion curators do all the time. So that's a rather cynical view of museum-based research, which suggests to us that perhaps the things that we've decided that we need to know about objects are actually driven much more by the processes of examination that we wish to be undertaking, and that it's actually an entirely retrofitted construction of research. In other words, anything that looks like a normal, everyday engagement with the object is going to be de-emphasized or ranked downwards in relationship to museum-based expertise, which perhaps, again, gets back to this question of sculpture versus applied art in some way by analogy. Maybe that's something we could return to later. But there, of course, are a lot of cracks in this edifice occurring now, and this is another thing that we haven't talked about today very much. But I don't know if you've noticed, but expertise has been having a rough ride for the past few years, and it's not just bankers. So, for example, if you were an encyclopedia editor 10 years ago, and you were to have fallen asleep and wake up in a Wikipedia age, what do you think you would have felt about the career you had devoted your life to? The realization that actually crowdsourced knowledge is vastly superior in every way, not only range, but also accuracy to what professional expertise could produce. At the V&A, we've been having a particular version of this issue because we've been suddenly taking a veering, headlong journey into the realm of popular culture. And I can tell you that in many cases, the V&A, now and in the future, will be doing exhibitions in which our visitors are much more expert than our staff. David Bowie, for example. How could a professional museum curator match the expertise of David Bowie that many of the audience members for that show will have? And similarly, if you take the example of Hollywood costume, which is up for one more day, so catch it tomorrow if you haven't. If you take the example of Hollywood costume, that happens to have been curated by a professional costume designer from the film business, Deborah Landis. But every visitor to that show will have a kind of sense of expertise or ownership over those garments that they're seeing, which is quite different from the ideas about costume design as a profession that Deborah is trying to put forward in the show, because they know where they were when they first saw Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, and what the museum says to them about that is probably not going to seem more important no matter what we say. It's a very different proposition to showing somebody an 18th century teapot, I think, in most cases. So you have this situation where museum-based expertise in general is suddenly threatened on all sides by a kind of superior set of claims, either the claim that actually expertise, even in the old sense of the term, in other words, compiling facts and being able to organize them in a systematic and useful way, is actually much better done by amateurs in large numbers, as through Wikipedia. And on the other hand, that the kinds of expertise that the museum always laid claim to, by turning things upside down and putting them under X-ray machines, actually doesn't matter very much compared to the effects that they can have in the public realm. And of course, a lot of this has to do with the spectacularization of museums as an economy. Another way of looking at the same problem is to think about the history of museum objects being used for purposes that would not normally find approval at a place like the V&A or the museum in Cardiff. So for example, what about using museum objects as props in a film? You may or may not know of a film version that was done of War and Peace in the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. Essentially what had happened was that the Americans had just come out with a version of War and Peace starring Audrey Hepburn, and it was a huge hit in Russia. The authorities were extremely upset about this because the 150th anniversary of the book was coming up in the War of 1812, and so they decided to launch into a Soviet version of this story. The ultimate film is something like 8 hours long, I saw it in one sitting recently. And because it was done under a dictatorship, they requisitioned the army to make the film. So all of the military scenes were done with actual units from the Soviet army. They reconstituted a cavalry unit to do the battle scenes, reforged cannon. But for the domestic scenes, they used objects from the Hermitage and other collections. And they also would just shoot on location. So for example, if Tolstoy had set a scene in the Winter Palace, they would just go to the Winter Palace and film it. It's amazing what you can do if you have a single-minded government on your side as a filmmaker. But at any rate, you wouldn't imagine most British museums nowadays countenancing such a use of their artifacts. And in fact, we are at the V&A asked all the time by art directors to use museum objects, and sometimes by fashion art directors for shoots. Can we borrow some of your 18th century clothes and sort of stick them on Naomi Campbell? So our answer to that is always no, but we do sometimes shoot films at the museum. For example, Hugo was shot in the Cass Courts, a little bit of Scorsese's film Hugo. and a little bit of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was shot in our offsite storage, fun fact. There's also more remote, but also, again, rather destabilizing examples, like the use of museum objects by reenactors. So people will study our objects and then copy them and wear them, which is sort of like what Kush and Andrew were doing at One Remove, you could say. And why is that not seen as legitimate research? Why is that seen as amateur? Going back a little bit further in history, it's fascinating to note that the V&A published very, very accurate measured drawings of its French furniture collection at the end of the late 19th century. And what do you think happened? Fakes, based on the drawings. And suddenly the market was full of objects that were based on the V&A's collection, completely fraudulent, and in some cases even offered them back to the V&A. Great story. And then at an even more remote level, you could say that creative industries in general, designers, craftspeople, artists, often use the V&A collection for purposes of inspiration and, of course, for copying, to simply copy to learn a trade. That's what Henry Cole thought the V&A was for in the first place. And in some ways, you could say that the V&A is like a giant Rorschach blot that creative industries in general see themselves in and then draw their own conclusions. And obviously, that's not only something that we can control, it's something we don't want to control. And it's a big argument that we make, big part of the argument that we make to government to keep our funding coming. But we don't seem to classify any of those things as museum-based research, at least not yet. So those are softer forms of challenge to the V&A's sense of control of expertise over our own collection, but ones that are growing day by day. And I'm almost done. I just want to suggest one other dynamic that's going to make this more and more and more significant and possibly will threaten to overwhelm traditional concepts of museum-based expertise in the future, and that, of course, is the digital landscape. Because now most design, again, you will have noticed this, but it may not have occurred to you that it's an issue for a place like the V&A, most design now is digital. So we stand in relation to digital practice today, much as the museum stood in relation to plastics in the 1930s or photography in the 1850s. It's the technology that's changing the face of the very fields in which we collect. Now, as it happens, the V&A was one of the very first museums in the world to start collecting photography. We even collected Julia Margaret Cameron photographs from her and had a one-woman show for her in the late 19th century. We didn't get on to collecting plastics until something like the 1980s. And in fact, we still don't have a plastics department. Have ceramics, have wood, have textiles, have metal, no plastics, even though most design since the 1930s has indeed been in plastic. So we move slowly on these things. But we've been talking a lot recently about the fact that we can't make the same mistake with digital design that we made with plastics. We have to respond to it more as the museum did at its inception with photography. In other words, we need to get on top of it now, and we need to lead from the front in terms of our strategy for collecting this material. But ask yourself this question. If you were a curator at the V&A, how would you collect Facebook? One of the most important design phenomena of our times, surely, or Twitter, the slightly more well-designed interface. How would you collect a video game? Our new head of contemporary at the V&A, Kieran Long, is very interested in video games, although he's principally an architectural critic and historian. And when we asked him why he was so interested in video games, he pointed out that the amount of skilled workmanship and labor and knowledge production that goes into the making of one video game, like Grand Theft Auto 4, is roughly the same amount that goes into the making of a skyscraper like the Shard. Right? About the same number of people, and probably the finances are about the same. And that makes you think, we probably should be paying attention to that. But how do you collect a video game? Do you let people in the gallery use it? Do you let people use it remotely? Do you put it online? And then in what sense, is the V&A different from the company? So in other words, if you can access Facebook and interact with it through the V&A website, how are we different from Facebook? What is the dissonance or the space between us and the company that's going to provide that difference? And of course, since many of these companies, beginning with Google, but many, many others, deal precisely in information, as we do, that creates even more proximity between the museum and what used to be a completely discrete private sector. It's even starting to become an issue in 3D. I was talking to a specialist in 3D printing, which is another thing that you heard about from Andrew, recently, and he said that they have already worked out ways to make photorealistic 3D prints, in other words, tinted 3D prints. And he showed me a picture of his own face, which they had managed to print in their laboratory, and all the tints were exactly the same, so it looked like a death mask taken by plaster and then very, very skillfully painted. Of course, the difference is you can print as many of them as you want using tinted adhesives to color the printing material. And we also spoke about the possibility of nanotechnology becoming a means of preserving information about objects. And he said that you'd have to do the math, but he thought that probably at some point in the relatively near future, if you had the 3D scans, in other words, if you had the information in digital form, you could print a nano version of the V&A's entire collection, all 4 million objects, and fit it in a shoebox. Why not? Wouldn't present any storage issues. And you'd have all the information, in other words, the topology of the object in the collection. Does it make sense to start researching that if you're the V&A? You can see how radically this destabilizes our sense of what curatorial expertise might be, what it might look like, and how we might spend our limited resources in terms of research. So that's a lot of ideas to throw at you, but I just want to conclude by saying a couple of last things. One is to get back to something Callum said, which I absolutely loved, which was the candle problem. The idea that if you go into a historic house, there's this how do you deal with the illumination? Do you mock something up? Do you adopt an expressly artificial mode of illumination that has nothing to do with the original context of the building? And in some ways, what this question rotates around is precisely that difference between strong and weak agency of objects that I described earlier. Are you more concerned with the fact of the object, or are you more concerned with its effects? Are you concerned with the object's potential to be a special effect? And what you do with it in the gallery is meant only to produce a certain emotive reaction, or are you more concerned with it as a data point? And how does strength and weakness that's inherent in the object in some ways, always in a different way, how does that play through in that dialectic? So all objects are both strong and weak at the same time, and their strengths are produced by their weaknesses, and conversely. Same thing with Leech's Chanoyu tea ceremony wares, which equally were involved in a kind of mocked-up display. And in many ways, what Leech was trying to do with tea ceremony, for all of his seriousness, was not too far away from what a historic house person has to deal with when thinking about whether to use fake candles or not. How much do you mock up? How much do you engage in special effects? You're going to be engaging in evocation and invocation no matter what you do, but how do you want to do it? And how do you consider your relationship to facticity as opposed to spectacle in that equation? And that becomes ultimately the sort of question that research itself needs to wrap its head around. It's not that any longer we can consider research to be a compiling of facts that can then be interpreted over by the learning department. In fact, those two things are collapsing into one unvariegated continuum of activity. So what this produces, I think, is a situation in which the audience, curators, artists, conservators, interpreters, everybody involved with museums, is not in a one-way street in relationship to the objects, as Benjamin was, but instead a two-way street, or perhaps a gigantic megaplex of crisscrossing highways that comes to have the same degree of complexity as the internet itself. So, thank you very much.
I'm delighted to say my responsibility is over for the day now. I'm going to actually pass the baton over to Mark, who's going to lead the afternoon discussion.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me at the back? Excellent. Thank you for spending the day with us and for hanging out till the bitter end. It's been a fantastically stimulating and enjoyable day. So I'd just like to thank all of the speakers for their wonderful presentations. Give them one of these. Thanks also to the Anna Freud Centre, to the Freud Museum, to Carol and Ivan for all of their involvement in setting these things up. to Christy and the Ceramics Research Centre crew for all their work. Also to the University of Westminster and the AHRC to their support of various kinds over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, making this project happen and allowing it to be sustained.
Not quite five.
Feels like five. Yeah. So I had a series of ideas that I was going to put forward. I was meant to spend the day listening and pulling out common themes and drawing them together and offering them back to you. But Glenn did such a good job of that as a respondent in his session that I think I might just open it to the floor. So we have just under an hour, and the opportunity is there for you to continue contributing. You should feel free to ask questions to anyone up here, maybe even questions in general that particular people might want to pick up on. We're going to pass this around, and if there are one of these floating around, excellent. Thank you, Ivan. So, do any of you want to ask questions to each other first? Any? Let's. Yeah, you've been very patient. Let's throw it open. There's a question towards the back on the right, gentleman with the nice glasses.
That's technology. It's really kind of following up some of the points that Glenn was making. I think it was about 15 years ago, Roger Law made a film called Smashing Pots with Johnny Vegas, the comedian, who had previously trained as a potter. And for that, Johnny Vegas smashed all these pots of contemporary British potters, and I believe that something like 95% of the pots were genuine. They were donated by the artists themselves. I thought that was a very interesting way in which a reality of making pots was sort of revealed in a very humorous way that never kind of rarely gets that kind of exposure, and how that sort of contrasted with the tea ceremony we saw on the film, in a sense how polite that was, and how there was a sense of the authentic use of the tea surface was somehow being revealed through the process of drinking from it. And I suppose my thought is that somehow not drink, if you drank out of a Barbara Hepworth, you were somehow violating its real, genuine meaning. And if you were drinking out of the tea service, you were in some way validating it. Whereas, in fact, in many ways, a lot of contemporary potters, ceramicists, have wished to move into another set of values. And I was curious, in a way, whether the tea service was in some way giving value to the ritual of drinking tea, whether it was about that, or whether it was about the valuing of the objects in some other kind of way. And it seems to me many makers have moved away from the utilitarian in order to try and draw attention to a certain set of values. Mm-hmm. Is that rather...
Yeah. Well, one can certainly think about, well, there are many examples of broken pottery, or the act of breaking pottery as an art project. I suppose, as in many other cases, one needs to, I think, embrace the idea that fine and applied arts, insofar as they're no longer distinct categories, need to be treated as on a plane of equivalence with one another. And so a project like that, you probably want to think alongside, well, Claire Toomey's work here in the front, or Ai Weiwei dropping the ancient Chinese vessel. I'm sure we can come up with more examples as a group. I suppose that for me, and I think this gets back to your idea of coziness, Andrew, it's probably useful to think about zones of permission. So who are the people participating, and can they give permission? So obviously the ancient potter who made the pot that Ai Weiwei is smashing certainly can't. And also you might think that the public has an interest in that object in a way that they perhaps don't have in a contemporary object that can be made again. And, you know, the permission that a contemporary potter gives to Johnny Vegas can't really be extended by anyone. for an ancient artifact. And so I think there probably are lots of lines of power and control and responsibility that can be crossed through very simple acts of fracturing and fragmentation. But on the other hand, I sort of think that fine art has done quite a good job of doing those gestures to death so that they no longer have much ability to shock. I think it is interesting that Andrew, you and your tea service seems somehow still have a quality of discomfort to it after all the relational aesthetics that the art world has been able to serve up to us, and yet it still seemed to, well, make you a bit uncomfortable. And I think there was still a kind of free zone in the room while you were showing that film. And so I think that perhaps speaks to the idea that there are zones of permission that mapped onto zones of activity with their own norms, and maybe there's something to be said for the applied arts as a space where these things don't happen, so that when they do, it means more. I don't know.
I mean, that's very interesting. One of the most interesting experiences was looking at the film after going through the process of serving the tea and drinking it and so on. And I look at myself speaking and think, I think, as I said, I seem to be very diffident and unsure about what's going on. But were I to do it again, I'd feel much more confident about it. And I did raise the issue about who this was for, who it's involving. And I personally would now be prepared to do something similar to that, you know, pour somebody some beer out of an 18th century beer jug or whatever into an 18th century tankard and share a beer with them. I'd be prepared to do that with anybody, with a member of the public, you know, why not, and see what would happen. I think you have to, you know, the other part of me, as I mentioned in the film, is about preserving these objects for future generations to be able to do that sort of thing as well. So I wouldn't ever be cavalier about it, and I'm not going to start dropping things on the gallery floor. But going through that for me was a process of object-based research, and by using the objects I actually learned something about the design of the objects, about how they make you behave. Part of that is due to the awareness of it being 200 years old that I brought with me, and being perhaps a bit more delicate in that way, but also using them as functioning objects was a process of research. So what I'm saying is, in terms of levels of permission, I think my approach is a sort of gradual approach, and by trying new things out in a relatively safe environment, I think it leads on to more adventurous things, hopefully, in the future.
I'm just wondering whether the applied arts world is, though, still a little more cautious and reticent about doing these things. I don't have any special details in my memory, but I know that it's quite some years ago, and either Mark or Glenn might know, or someone in the audience might know this, that the artist, it must be 6-7 years ago, the artist Julian Walker, Julian Walker was allowed to move into Kettle's Yard and live there for a week with his wife and his 2-year-old toddler. And I think that level of risk-taking, you know, I don't know whether you have any more facts about it. I just remember reading about this and thinking that was an extraordinary act of sort of courage on behalf of the curators of Kettle's Yard to actually use the house in the way that it was originally used, but to actually also let, you know, a strange toddler in. I thought it took real nerve, actually.
I don't know if this is a question, but I keep on thinking about Carol's Pendle problem, which I thought was very, very pathetic in some way. And Glenn, you then asked about the passive object, and then you also asked about what the objects want. And it seems to me that there is a conundrum of showing so many objects in museums, which is that one is denuding them of the very things that Andrew's film was revealing, which is a social context. It's not functionality in a kind of very specific way, but it's the wider social context of objects. And I think, I don't know if this is a question. I'm just kind of trying to put these things together in my mind. I wonder if you see that there's a kind of a connection between how does one get over this issue of, candles and what they actually did, and then somehow reproducing that, and the passivity of objects in museums, and then if they were allowed to have a free reign, what would they actually want from the curators and the audience? And it seems to me social context is something that is so elusive and difficult for the museums to represent.
Yeah, I think that actually social context is encoded very powerfully into objects, which is why they make such good evidence. One thing that perhaps I could have made more explicit in my remarks is that usage and everything that's attached to usage, even poetic association, is physically inscribed into objects in a very powerful way. So, for example, I used the example of Barbara Hepworth's sculpture, and I don't know what you had in your mind when I said that, but what if I were to say, what about drinking tea out of Brancusi's Bird in Space? Well, that would be physically impossible, in fact. And I think in much more nuanced ways, the fact that something has a handle, the fact of it being made of a certain material and so on, the affordances that it has, this is where you start thinking about objects in almost like a modernist designer. They do give you lots and lots of cues that are probably quite evident, certainly to someone in the same culture, but even to someone in another culture, which is why artifacts are such powerful mechanisms of global exchange of ideas in the way that things in language aren't, for example, because you can't read another person's language. You can certainly drink out of their tea bowls. And so I think we do tend to vastly overrate the amount of decontextualization that happens when an object passes into a museum. And that's why, although again, I would stress that it's a rather metaphorical thing, and I'd be curious to know what Esther has to say about this idea of objects having agency. I think that's a rather loose way of talking, but it does seem to me that even on that basic level of form, they do exert a lot of, they do communicate with you in a very active way that we tend to perhaps underrate. Obviously, I'd like to know what Colin has to say about candles.
Yes, candles, my special area of expertise. The whole candle, the logical outcome of that question about the candles, I was contained in the very last sentence of my talk, just before I said museums are dangerous. I said that maybe not everything has to be a display, I think, and maybe not everything has to be in a museum, works to that effect. And I think that when you get to the point of having to ask the question about the candle, that's also when you should think, is this museum really necessary? There is a tendency to believe that we can make museums of anything. And I've got some sympathy with that, but I think that there are some things that are best left unmuseumed. I'm so grateful that there isn't a Walter Benjamin museum, because there's the arcade project. That's what you need. You don't need the museum. And the museum that I showed pictures of without naming, do we really need that? I don't know. Does that happens to be the house that he lived in for a while? Do we really need that as a museum? What is it giving us that his work isn't giving us? It's a different point.
Glenn, you said that objects had a lot of encoding embedded, but do they? Because you talked about the limitations of curatorial, effectively, kind of measurement, x-raying and photographing and scanning. But objects are handled, and there's one thing that just never comes across in any sort of description of objects, because it's very elusive and it's kind of, I suppose, very subjective, but it's talking about haptical qualities of objects. So, you know, how does something feel in the hand? You know, the weight. One has a visceral relationship with things, and, you know, that's what, you know, we come up time and time again over with the houses and the way that people have collected objects. Their physical, visceral, haptical relationships. And yet in a museum, you know, that kind of then just completely disappears off the radar, because unless it's a very special event, you can't handle the objects. So I don't know how, I still think there's, you know, incredible kind of limitations to how you can kind of, you know, start to put, you know, the whole picture of an object. You know, you can never do the whole picture, but to put a pretty complete picture of an object across through conventional interpretation. Maybe I'm coming around to agreeing with you that maybe, you know, museums are unnecessary. I don't know.
Well, I'm lowering the tone totally, but reading some newspaper on the plane yesterday, and its column started a column in it which was all about the scandal that £32,000 has been spent taking a bunch of school students to New York to have experiences, the sporting experience, the Broadway experience. And the man begins his column by saying, I've been to the Freud House in the Berggasse in Vienna, and you can use the toilet that Freud used. And so I did, but I learned nothing about Freud from this, you know. And it's, and then goes on to, you know, dismiss this scandal of these kids being taken away, because surely we can, you know, somehow it's a denigration of experience. I wouldn't be so certain that one learns nothing by having that experience, either about toilets or about Freud's experience of that space. So somehow I want to counter that, that desire to somehow take it out of the experiential realm, which I think relates to, you know, certainly a haptic experience. I think it relates to that sort of idea of the object producing a context and somehow being expressive and allowing certain kinds of encounters, but which are not just factual ones then about knowing about its composition, but also fantastical and imaginative. And I mean, there was something else I wanted to say. I think it was sort of relevant around the question of use and non-use, because I was also thinking of those objects that need to be used. You know, what do objects want? Some objects might need a filling with liquid to prevent them decaying. So, you know, the house that's not used is the house that decays the most. And I find that really interesting as well, that use isn't necessarily a using up in a sense or a destruction. I wonder how far one can go with that.
Yeah, a really good example of that, a challenging one for us at the V&A, is musical instruments, because let's say a medieval lute or Renaissance lute needs to be held in tension, otherwise it cracks. Mm-hmm. It's designed to be held in tension. Yeah. So that presents you a bit of a problem. It's quite a special case that whether the object needs to be used to survive. But your comment, of course, brings to mind the Locus classic is of displaced ceramic art, the toilet, by certain French gentlemen. And
as Duchamp, you know.
Yeah, I suppose I tend to think of these things within a relational field, so that obviously you keep having an experience when you're looking at something through a glass case. You keep having a tactile experience, as anybody who's walked through a museum and heard the echoes and felt your feet on the 19th century floors and maybe even touch the case, the cold and see the case, all those things, you know, they are experiences as well, and I think they take on a kind of meaning through their withholdingness at the same time that they prevent you from having an experience of access. But at the same time, I do grant your point, Julian, that the haptic engagement with the object is highly motivating. I mean, the reason I'm sitting here today is because when I was a student, as an undergraduate, somebody put a Tang Dynasty plate in my hands. And I thought, oh, that's amazing, and kind of kept asking questions about that. Yeah, I published some ceramic review. The editors are smiling. But, you know, it was. I still remember that moment of electric contact between me and this
thousand-year-old thing, and that was what started me on the road to becoming an academic in this area, so I would be the last to deny its potency.
I was most interested in, and you just mentioned actually in the last set of comments, the vagueness of the notion of agency. And I was both interested in that, and if I'm assuming also a bit bothered by it, because I come from a philosophy perspective. So I was sort of wondering, both clarification, but maybe also just a looser reflection on the ambiguity, that is it that we're talking about the power of the object to provoke or affect a reaction in us, or precisely that power might be autonomous from the original maker or artist's intentions, so it's not tied down by an artist or maker's intention. Or are we actually talking about that further sense where we imagine or project a sense of intentionality or even personality into an object? And I suppose if it's the latter, then there are interesting questions about why, and is that just a kind of inherent way we relate to objects? So I'd be interested in asking the creators, the curators, whether they do that with the objects they work with, whether it depends on the type of object, and do you project intentionality on a teapot in the same way as you would with a figure. But then I was also wondering whether some of that projection of personality with historical objects comes from the sense it's been bestowed on them by all the people that have used them in the past, which perhaps moves away from seeing a dichotomy between the idea of the object as traces and the idea of the object as agency, and rather sees those two notions as connected in some way. But it's the trace of past usage that starts to give it that sense of being alive.
Yeah, that was a very eloquent version of the question. I kept noting as the day went on a variety of different animistic qualities that were being ascribed to various objects. Objects as passive, as weak, as strong, there was that discussion about agency, what came up, there was talking about animation, reflections, and utilizing inanimate objects. Christine was talking about stones, talking to archaeologists and objects having life of their own. Esther was talking about the way that they resonate. Karen was talking about evoking and invoking. And Andrew was even talking about object DNA. And it struck me that there were a number of different ways in which people were using the language of animism. Metaphorically, I think, in the way that animism was projected. But even so, there's something slightly more animistic about people's image of animism than it's really metaphorical. So, yeah, anyway, we're not going to resolve it. I'd be interested in a full poll to see how many people actually believe that objects have senses or ontology or animistic capacity. All those that do, please put your hand up. Put them up high, don't shy. Glenn has to put his hand up because that electricity was the beginning of his interest in becoming an academic. So, okay, so maybe half and half. Okay, so we're not going to get anywhere.
A question for Janice, isn't it? Because your automata are a very special case of this.
There are so many stories, so many fictional stories, if you like, but so many historical stories of objects, in a sense, having more than simply resonance, but appearing, as it were, to act, interact with us, that one can't disregard it. I mean, in a sense, from a sort of physical and chemical point of view, I sound even more mystical now. We're all one with the universe. Sorry, I should apologise. When you said that, I immediately thought of Oscar Wilde and his little aphorism, which I probably misquote, saying the real mysteries of the world are visible; they're not invisible. You know, it's the world that surrounds us that's the really remarkable thing. And I think there's going to be, this is not ever, Brian Cox has got a new television series, which is about matter and energy, which takes me right back to Prometheus and matter and energy, the building blocks of the universe. So I think that kind of, I'll move away from the atomic and molecular level, move off a bit. we have our own individual memories, and I think there's obviously there's an idea of collective memory as well, and that works very, very tellingly with objects. Plus, amulets, things, icons, etc. I don't want to necessarily just choose, as it were, precious or religious objects, but nevertheless, there is this sense of, with your teacups, touching something that was touched, used by somebody else 200 years ago. I'm putting things in a very simplistic way, and I apologise for that, but I think you have to kind of, if we're talking about objects, then you have to, in a sense, get back to basics like that. Now, obviously, a museum will always give an aura to an object, a particular kind of object. And I think one of the things that we've forgotten today a little bit about the term curator. It's not just as it tends to be these days used as a selector, somebody who chooses, somebody who arranges, somebody who investigates and researches. But its original meaning was to take care of an object. And in taking care of objects today, displaying research objects today, we can't second-guess the future, which I think is something that museums are always trying to do. That's just, I know that doesn't answer your question, but it's just a meditation around that area.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to come back?
In forensic medicine, they say there's no contact without a trace. And there's this notion of authenticity as well. I mean, the digital world is almost upon us, or is upon us, but nevertheless, it's not the real thing. And I think that's another discussion.
And I think there's a really interesting distinction between ontology of things and the way that Bill Brown and other people like Bill talk about the way that ontology becomes congealed in historical. I mean, there's a real tension to the historicity of that, which is part of what you're talking about, you know, that the labour, the materiality, the use, which somehow creates the sense of how they persist.
Can I just say my little response to that? I suppose for me, you know, I'm very interested in Marx's shift and the, you know, the extraordinary things he does around the notion of shifting from the religious context of the fetish to the commodity fetish. So I'm not so sure we don't still think we're completely surrounded by gods. They're just called iPhones or Burberry handbags or, you know, something else now. But and the shift that commodity fetishism brings about is, you know, the recognition this is not the projection of ourselves in a sense reflected back as gods, but it's the obscured and concealed conditions of production, the energy that produces these wonderful objects that then seem to themselves steal all the credit for that. So I suppose I just wanted to. People feel it's naughty. I thought that it's buy for Britain and it's absolutely your patriotic duty to shop us out of recession and everything, isn't it? But
Esther, can I ask you a question? The theory question, sorry, but I'm absolutely dying to ask you this at the moment, so I'm just going to do it. So that just distinction that moving to the commodity fetish in Marx's case, and then Benjamin's famous distinction between the aura of an evil icon and the aura of the loss of aura that attends mass production, the most famous argument you ever made, kind of. Mm. Do you think of those things as the same argument, or how do you relate them to
one? Yeah, well, I suppose so, because I think he then importantly puts in place this sort of notion of the fake aura that can very quickly accrue to, you know, a Hollywood star, as his example, or a dictator, or a particular object. So I think that there is a sort of category of the substitute fetish produced by the commodity, but there's a battle there that you know, his interest in Dada collage and using the scraps and detritus of industrial modernity can kind of shatter, I suppose, the power of the fetishistic power that those modern items might have. So they are both de-auraticized and sort of re-auraticized, but it's, we're talking about strong and weak, a sort of weak aura, because it's not really sustainable in the way that the aura of a specific and unique religious object or artwork is.
Because there's a postmodern way of dealing with this question which is raised here, which is and of course postmodernists were fascinated by Benjamin's argument for exactly this reason, that you know the object doesn't have agency, but you're going to pretend that it does, and within that set of scare quotes you can do an awful lot of work culturally, and you could say that our knowing ascription of things like agency to inanimate objects, just in the same way that we look at an automaton and we think how fun it is to pretend that that's a live swan even though we know it isn't.
My point in showing that film is people suspend their disbelief, and I don't think it's a willed act. I think people react in a very, not just with that particular artifact, but in, you get this thing where people just suspend their disbelief. They don't even think about it. They're not willing themselves to believe that that's alive. They're behaving as if it's alive.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is that they're actually having a two-level experience where they simultaneously know it's inanimate, and they're taking pleasure in its appearance as inanimate.
And they're suspending disbelief. No, it's like theatre, they suspend disbelief.
And an iPhone is just like the complex version of that in some ways.
Infinitely complex, but not infinitely more marvellous.
I just wanted to, I don't know, I mean, I'm not in any way an expert in this field, but I was in this very conference room a couple of years ago, and there was, just on that point about, you know, we don't have gods in our objects. That's a very kind of Western-centric viewpoint, isn't it? There was a conference here, and Ivan might remember and remind me, there was a gentleman anthropologist from South America. Was he bringing an object? I mean, he brought an object that was in a box, and inside this box was a god, and there was no question in his experience of where he had been and the people that he'd been with, that box contained that God, and he had been a long time with these people and was allowed to bring it here. So I had a very strong sense at that moment that there was this whole other world where these things still were just taken for granted, you know, in a way that we make all these questions about them, but this God was sitting in this box on this table. Remember that, Ivan?
Can I just say, product placement alert, that this in the book I'm about to come out with, The Invention of Craft, I make exactly that argument about craft, that craft is invented in precisely the way that you're talking about, and that museums are one of the social technologies by which craft is being as something that needs to be explained from the outside, can't explain itself, something slow, inefficient, traditional, static, all the things that it's constructed to be in the 19th century, and that it's precisely a factor within and also a product of modernity, and that it doesn't exist in our sense of using the term in the way that we're using it today until it's invented in that way. There you go. Bloomsbury. Used to be Berg, but they've been absorbed by the Harry Potter engine.
Hi, I just wanted to quickly say I love the idea of not being able to second-guess the future as a museum curator. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and when I was walking around the Freud Museum, I felt very sort of attached and loved to your porcelain figures that you'd made, because that reminds me of my grandmother's day, shall I say. Whereas I know my daughter has never been that attached to dolls, but if you bring out her original Game Boy... Oh, the love, you know, and and I think this is going to be what you have to deal with in the future, is that it's a very different, you know, the objects are very different now of what is precious to us. Will, when Clementine's sitting here, you know, in 20 years' time, speaking to you about it, will be very different.
I do think that's a good point about transitional objects, because, you know, in Winnicott's view, sort of just underneath Freud, if you like, in the British pantheon of psychoanalysis, I realise it's a bit contentious thing to say, but Winnicott's view, you know, that you can use anything is a transitional object, if it works for you, which is again, it's quite a British view of the object. I mean, I realise it's contentious worldwide in psychoanalytic circles, but this is that thing. It's not necessarily the view, the value that the society puts on it. It's the value that the individual puts on it. And if it works, what that work is a different matter, and again, a very individual thing. And I do think, looking around the Freud Museum, what struck me first of all was, like, not the fetishistic nature of the objects or the fact that it's Dr. Freud's shrine, which is it certainly is, but simply that there's so much here that seems so well used in the practical sense, the physical sense, but also in, if you like, a more psychological sense.
Well, I think the V&A and Science Museum and various other repositories. This is fun. This is like a complicated party game. You have to. Well, also, you know, technology proves is very challenging to connect, because of course the Game Boys. Will you actually be able to play them or appreciate them, or will they just be shells in 20 years' time? Yeah, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
I was sort of following on from the discussion about objects and agency. Objects as formed. Like this, right up close. The Tropen Museum in Amsterdam, they have a collection of oceanic art, and they have these oars from Papua New Guinea, which have a sequence of marks on each oar, which recall acoustically, really like a musical score, the movement of the oar in the water, but also the water. And the method of also reenacts the.
Maybe I should repeat some of that if I possibly can for the back of the room. So you were asking about the way that objects attune somebody to a certain motion or experience. So, and M.C. Richards, who's an American poet who was at Black Mountain College and learned throw pottery, speaks about this experience of throwing the pot as having a centering effect on herself in a very holistic way. And I think here she's also thinking about a sense in which you are losing yourself to find yourself, which is a very Buddhist concept, I think, and one that kicks around an awful lot in mid-century pottery circles. So you're wondering whether museum objects can somehow perform this, even if they're not physically being used. Is that right? Yeah.
I can perhaps respond to that, having done something of the kind with that tea set that you saw the film of. That did attune me to the way that object or those objects were intended to be used, because they physically make you behave or hold them in a particular way. So I think museum objects certainly can do that. And probably should do that more.
One thing I've noticed just quickly is that if you use film in a museum environment, it tends to be much more powerful than an object. So, for example, if you show somebody a film of someone throwing a pot, they'll stare and stare and stare at it, and they won't look at the pot that's right next to it. They might check it once, as if verifying somehow in some imaginary kinesthetic way that the one thing does connect to the other. But there is something awfully strong, if you accept that term that I was using, in the in the physical performance of craft. And I think that this is something I've thought about a little bit, that, you know, one of craft's problems is that people really, really love it while it's happening, and then something's left behind, and it becomes a commodity, and that's where all the problems start. But when craft is actually being performed as an activity kinesthetically, it's very difficult to find anyone that objects to it, and I think the problem opens up when the thing does become static, and obviously that's when it becomes museumified.
Yeah, but that's what I was wondering. Is it particular to craft? I mean, I keep coming back to that lovely Nabokov phrase about the sleep of substance, that the process of putting in the museum is the putting to sleep, or it's the patient in the hospital bed. I mean, I'm fascinated by how, as you were saying, there's sort of animistic things, but there's things around life and vivification, and having just come back from Bergen, where was one trip I took was to the Natural History Museum, which is one of those rare museums that has not yet been renovated. And, you know, so that the standard 19th century model of lots and lots of stuff laid out, and the rooms aren't particularly well illuminated, and how that then comes to be seen as having a certain quaintness or charm. And we saw a presentation at the conference I was at about the regeneration of the Rasmus Meyer Museum, which they are taking back to its original state, getting back to the original colours on the walls, the original hang, which is very, very cluttered when it was originally hung, and it's been through a sort of modernist phase and so on. But there's no faith, in a sense, in the object speaking, so the vivification comes from the interactivity that is assumed never to already be there between the audience and the object, but can only be delivered through these digital interfaces. And I just wonder what discourses around vivification and the life of the object existed in an earlier phase, or whether that was a question at all, or if it's only become a question for us that, yeah, perhaps connected to these technologies that precisely are not alive but come to stand in for the liveliness within the museum.
Of course, religious object presented, you know, as things, right? Not representations of things. So the minute you lose God, or you lose the soul, or whatever it happens to, you know, you are already a representation. Question over there. I had a quick question going back to Glenn's discussion of the spectacularization of museums, and now you were just talking about using film and what it does and how audiences are actually happy to stand there. And I was thinking about that in relation to the question of the importance of the contemporary perspective that Andrew was talking about, as opposed to the social perspective that we've been in. I was also thinking about your discussion of how we are going to be more contemporary perspective, the popular stuff, and hearing those kinds of things about a whole variety of things from the closing of
Well, to come back to this point about agency, my perspective is that objects are inert stuff
and that the agency that we perceive them to have is all something that's generated by us. And you could, you can, you know, for example, I could come across a Chinese porcelain plate in our collection, and to all intents and purposes, that's as much as we know about it. If I then suddenly discover the inventory, which tells me that it was acquired by Thomas Stepney of Llanelli in 1762, as happened recently, then it becomes that object, takes on a stronger agency. But that's not something that has been inherent to the object. That's something I've brought to it, and then the object can be a tool in engaging more widely. But I think if we remove the ability of museums to do the kind of research that brings that new knowledge, then what we're presenting, what the public are engaging with, is I think ill-informed, potentially random. I think the increasing tendency is to misunderstand what curatorship is about. We're going through a restructuring process at the moment, and there's a proposal suddenly to have a new breed of learning curators. What kind of curatorship that involves, it remains to be seen, and leaves me feeling a bit confused. So I'm beginning to rant, but you know.
Go on.
I agree with your point, yeah.
Shall I just say something very quickly? Well, the spectacularization of the V&A is a subject that could keep us here all night, probably. My own feeling as head of research is that I would honestly say that I feel like that process has been undertaken in quite a serious and thoughtful way. And so for me, for example, there's a big difference between doing a show about Hollywood costume that also explains to you what the profession of a Hollywood costume designer is and is driven by many years of archival research, and doing it just by borrowing the costumes and trying to get the most high box office movies you can. And that is an absolutely critical difference. And I would also say, for what it's worth, that there's a big difference between doing a David Bowie show and a Kylie Minogue show, which we have also done. And I would be willing to fight long and hard to keep a show about David Bowie in the program. I'm not sure that had I been head of research when I was Kylie, the Exhibition, which really made us want to call our show Postmodernism, the Exhibition. We weren't allowed to. But I think that there's a world of difference in what could also, from some perspective, be seen as a rather nuanced difference in this process of spectacularization. Whether that amount of focus on those details is missing a larger picture, I'm not totally sure. I might grant that that's a possibility. But for what it's worth, I think you can bring just as much meaningful attention and research to David Bowie as you can to Chinese porcelain. And I also think that insofar as museums, especially big museums like the V&A, are economies where things counterbalance, so that doing the David Bowie show allows you to keep the Chinese porcelain curator employed, I myself feel like it's worth trying to find that exactly that right line. But it's damn hard, I will tell you.
in my experience, many visitors will come to a museum looking for a particular object or a particular group of objects and expect it to be in a particular place and think, you know, where's that Monet? You know, it should be here when we've moved it to another gallery. I think it's healthy if we, to use a word that Edmund used, I think it's healthy to think of what we do as provisional, and objects have potential to have an interesting and active social life, and I think they need to be allowed that potential. Not every object is going to be partying all the time, so you know it's. I think we just need to be imaginative, dynamic, move things around, try things out, experiment a bit, and so on. But the problem is that all that comes as a cost of resources, and the fewer people like me there are around, the less it will happen. So, but you know, I think that's the way I view at it. The way I look at it, things, for practical reasons, tend to stay stuck in the same place for a long time, and I see that as a source of regret. But it's a fact of life in most museums at the moment, I'm afraid.
They will be partying up at the Freud Museum from 5 o'clock.
Is this a happy update question or comment? Are you still in there? Do you want to rephrase it so that we all need full exploring? Well, I'm not going to take that long. I'll just comment on what I was going to say. And see where it takes us. The title of the stage is Rank and Spanish Hill. I'm going to go right back to you. And then we've got first of all, interpreting places. You spent a lot of time for that object, for example. I'm not an object person anymore. I was in a past life. I was not before. Rank doesn't just represent object. You really doesn't just represent object. What about all the other possibilities that Spanish Hill represents? Wrong object.
Subject
for the next conference.
So, yeah, let's see. Oh, is it really? Excellent. Feel free to advertise that in a second. Go for it. Very quick response. Yes, absolutely, sir.
Well, I was actually about to just say, you know, I'm not very interested in the tactile small object that you can hold in your hand. I mean, I know I've made some that are that kind of scale, but I mean, I am much more interested in the object as sculpture and the object as something that is not necessarily an intimate handheld thing you drink your tea out of. I'm much more interested in the Hepworth end of it as something else, some other presence which doesn't necessarily have that intimate connection. And I think we do in ceramics tend to kind of drift off into that area a little bit, and but I think you're absolutely right, Richard, and that is something that we're all within our ceramics in the expanded field, and this is one of three symposia, and we'll have a very big conference around this project in April 2014 where we hopefully those strands will come in. This one has been quite object focused, quite site focused, quite idea focused, so just say it has been those other things as well.
Just very quickly, I mean, before you guys carry on, it might be worth mentioning a couple of forthcoming events that are connected to this. One at Somerset House that somebody was talking about earlier. Is that you? Wherever you are? No? There was a flyer outside about it. And also at University of Westminster in March. Which is being organised by a ceramicist who works in time-based media. Yeah. So this issue will be integral, I would imagine, to that.
Well, I was just going to give a less institutional answer, which is I grant your point, Richard. I think from my perspective, and maybe you would expect me to say this coming from the V&A, but I think that in a funny sense, time-based and performative and media-based work in a museum almost presents less of a challenge in a 21st century context, except insofar as that it implies that museums are becoming much more continuous with other edifices within the culture industry. So, you know, the difference between going to see Christian Marclay's The Clock in a gallery and going to see a show at the BFI, or a film at the BFI, is actually not that great, really. And you can similarly say the same for performance art in theater. You could say the same for kind of any durational artistic construct. We sort of understand those things, and what it does for me is to create, as I say, a kind of continuum of institutions, especially in a city like London where we're all working together anyway. I think for me, and this is why I would sort of stick up for the idea of object-led research as a particular problem that's worth chewing over, and indeed even thinking about craft as a problem that's still worth chewing over in the 21st century, is that it does present certain forms of friction and difficulty to the act of spectacularization, the act of interpretation, the act of performance, the act of vivification, that really are not going to go away no matter how much digital technology we chuck at them. And I feel like working through those problems is still very, very, I think we're still at a very early stage of doing that, to be honest, despite all the conversation we've been having. So I would stick up for the object as still being a very, very interesting and compelling problem to solve for those of us in museums after all this time.
Great, thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you all for your questions and comments. I'm thinking Christy would like to say a few words. Julian.
Siegel, and for Ivan for looking after us so well, the Anna Freud Centre in the Freud Museum, AHRC for funding of the project, and Westminster University for their help in facilitating it. Most importantly, our speakers for their fantastic papers, Mark for chairing this afternoon's session, Claire Toomey for all of her help in the project and with the behind-the-scenes work on the symposium, but particularly Christy for her exhibition and, of course, for bringing us all here in the first place. And that's a big thank you from all of us. And most importantly, I suppose, thank you for making it a really wonderful day. So thanks for your attendance.